1942-17, James Thompson versus Marietta Education Association and Marietta Board of Education. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes for plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Mr. Robert Ault, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Ault, and I'm counsel for appellant Jay Thompson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The core issue in this case is about the difference between two words, speaking and listening. My client is compelled to associate and thus to speak through an unwanted representative with whom she disagrees. This the Constitution forbids. Opposing counsel and the court below argue that this case should be controlled by Knight, a case that says that the government cannot be compelled to listen. But my client makes no demand that the government listen to her. Her fundamental argument is that the state cannot constitutionally force her into an expressive association with a designated representative with whom she disagrees so that it can speak for her in collective bargaining.
Mr. Ault, so I get that argument and it makes a lot of sense, but I guess what I'm struggling with, just to be candid with you, is your reading of Knight. Knight seems pretty expansive to me, and maybe you can explain to me, because if you look at the end of the first paragraph of the opinion Justice O'Connor delivers, she says the question presented in this case is whether this restriction on participation in the non-mandatory subject exchange process violates the constitutional rights of professional employees. And then it goes within the bargaining unit who are not members of the collector representative. And so I guess that seems a pretty broad question presented and holding. And I get that maybe in a post-Janus world, the Supreme Court would want to revisit that holding in Knight, but the Supreme Court in Janus didn't overrule Knight. And so what are we to do with the breadth of that question presented and answer to it?
If you take a look at the way the question is presented, again, I think it goes to compulsory participation and listening was the core of the issue. The issue of compelled speech and compelled association, the claims that we are raising, were neither raised nor expressly addressed. Going to the language in that case, the court noted that the question presented in these cases is whether the restriction on participation in the non-mandatory subject exchange process violates the constitutional rights of professional employees within the bargaining unit who are not members. That's our point exactly. Once again, they were...
But weren't the professors there raising... I'm sorry to interrupt you, by the way. Weren't the professors there raising this almost identical argument to what you're raising here? I get how the court went about it. But I guess my question is, it seems like it's on all fours in a lot of ways.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the plaintiffs in that case raised a very different argument. First, actually, their frontal assault with regard to exclusive representation, and I'd like to correct an error that was made by unions counsel in their brief at page, I believe, 17, was not one that was based upon the First Amendment in the first pass, the pass that was where the court summarily affirmed. It was actually based upon a non-delegation theory in the Schechter poultry case. That was where the court summarily affirmed, not on a First Amendment basis. When they raised the claim in this full merits review, once again, it was attempting to force their way into the negotiation process. They had a right to be heard. They in fact were trying to force the board to listen to their particular statements. That's very different than what we're arguing here.
I'm sorry. What is your client ultimately trying to get here? Because if not that, what? Like, what is the client's ultimate goal?
My client in particular is seeking relief from the dignitary harm that's caused by the expressive association and forced representation. And that way, I would say that her claim is very similar to that which was raised in Hurley. She doesn't wish to be forced to associate. That causes her a great harm. It causes very little harm, quite frankly, to the union and to the board, who could presumably, if the court were to rule with us on this first argument, could continue conducting business essentially as usual, but not compelling the association on the part of our client.
So if the union were to announce that your client was not a part of it, would that satisfy her?
Unfortunately, no, Your Honor, because she is a part of it as a matter of state law. State law is perfectly clear on this point, that the union is the representative of all employees in the unit, including Ms. Thompson. And so even if the union were to disavow, they could not disavow the operation of state law.
And are you asking us to basically blue pencil the statute itself?
Your Honor, what we ask for is declaration that the operation of the statute in that way violates the First Amendment rights of non-members, and we would seek an injunction preventing the board from, in fact, applying it in that way. But to your point in general on Knight, I think it's worth emphasizing there. The court, 9 separate times in the opinion, went back to the fact that this is about forced participation, compelling listening. That was the core of that particular case. And you know, by contrast, the opposing counsel takes a line of dicta of Knight out of context and argues that that should control the case. The union quotes Knight for the proposition that instructors retain the, quote, freedom not to associate with whom they please, including the exclusive representative. But context matters. Knight actually said that appellee's speech and associational rights, however, have not been infringed by Minnesota's restriction of participation in meet and confer sessions to the faculty's exclusive representative. It's only then that the court goes on to state that the state has in no way restrained appellee's freedom to speak on any education-related issue or their freedom to associate or not associate. All of that is a claim related to the restriction of participation, not to compelled speech, which was neither raised nor considered. Simply put, the claim was not made, the Knight Court did not consider, and the Knight Court did not rule on the question before this court today, whether a non-member may be compelled to speak through a representative she views as adverse to her interests.
What is your strongest argument for why this is unconstitutional? Set Knight aside for a second and just tell us your strongest argument.
Your Honor, I think that the strongest argument arises from under expressive association. And here, the relationship between the union as representative and Ms. Thompson is clearly one of expressive association. Janice held that public sector collective bargaining is to be concerned overwhelmingly with questions of public concern and paid particular attention to education policy issues, including seniority and tenure, issues which Ms. Thompson has identified in her affidavit as being issues with which she disagrees with the union's position. As the Supreme Court held in Boy Scouts versus Dale, where parties come to engage in some form of expression, that is an expressive association, which is subject to First Amendment scrutiny. Compelling objecting employees like Ms. Thompson to associate with the union impinges on their associational rights because the First Amendment protects the freedom not to associate. Again, as in the Hurley decision, it's worth keeping in mind. The organizers of the parade in Hurley didn't need to say anything. They were forced to associate with one group among the roughly 20,000 participants in the parade. But this was a First Amendment harm to expressive association sufficient to overcome the state's interest in promoting anti-discrimination in public accommodations. Here, Ms. Thompson doesn't want to associate with the union, and for good reason, because she disagrees with them on issues that the Supreme Court has found to be overwhelmingly matters of public concern. Like Hurley, it doesn't matter whether others believe she agrees with the speech or whether she repudiates the speech. She suffers First Amendment harm by the forced expressive association itself, just like the parade organizers. In this sense, the statute operates like the one struck down in California Democratic Party versus Jones. There, the statute expressly designated the open primary winner as the nominee of the party in the ensuing general election. The court found it unconstitutional because it forced political parties to associate with persons the parties may not agree or want to associate with. Here, Ohio statute expressly designates the union as Ms. Thompson's representative. It forces Ms. Thompson to associate with a group she does not wish to associate with. And on the question of compelled speech, the offense is also equally clear, as is the statute. The union is the representative of Ms. Thompson as it is for, quote, all the public employees, end quote, in the unit. And the collective bargaining agreement states that the unit is, quote, the sole exclusive bargaining agent for the members in the bargaining unit. Ohio law does not.
Mr. Oll, I guess I'm getting back to the practicality of this. So you would require the school board to negotiate with each individual teacher who is not a member of the union and bargain with each non-member? Is that the ultimate bottom line of this?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, that would be very similar to the claim that was raised by the petitioners in Knight. We don't claim a right to be heard or a right to participate in the negotiations. And that's a core distinction here. What we claim is that we can't be forced to associate first.
You're not a member of the union, so you're not forced to associate. If it were not for the Ohio labor law, your client would be an at-will employee. And were not for this labor law, the school board could have any terms they wished. They could impose whatever terms they want on the teachers, and they could either work or not. And there'd be no duty to bargain at all. So I just don't quite understand what you're after here.
What we're after is, number one, notwithstanding the fact that Ms. Thompson is not a member of the union, she still is forced to associate with it in an expressive association by virtue of the Ohio statute. To say that in the absence of the statute, she wouldn't be associating with them is like saying in the absence of the statute in California, the parties wouldn't be forced to associate with individuals who they didn't choose. That's the core of the case. That statute, in fact, imposes that burden upon Ms. Thompson. In terms of whether or not she has any particular protections, I would argue that even in the absence of this particular rule, the Constitution imposes particular protections by virtue of, I see that my time is up. May I simply finish my sentence here, Your
Yes,
Honor?
Yes, please.
The Constitution still imposes particular protections upon or for my plaintiff on the government as an actor. They're not allowed to discriminate between members and non-members. And so whether in Steele or Janus, which relied upon Steele, that protection would still attend to my client, even in the absence of exclusive representation.
All right, you'll have your rebuttal time. Mr. Cronlin, my understanding is that you're going to take 12 minutes of time and then Mr. Schmink will take the other three, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You may begin.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Cronland representing the Marietta Education Association. Ohio uses the same democratic system of exclusive representative bargaining as the federal government and about 40 other states. In the absence of an agency fee requirement, or indeed a requirement that the members of the bargaining unit do or say anything to support the union, these exclusive representation systems don't violate the First Amendment. The district court was right that
it seems to me, though, from a first, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems to me from a first principles perspective, I mean, aren't the privileges afforded to exclusive bargaining representatives? I mean, it seems like patent viewpoint discrimination.
Well, it's not viewpoint discrimination. The Supreme Court addressed it in Perry Education Association. It's based on status. They're the majority chosen representative, and therefore they can be afforded on that basis certain
so the
things.
The minority, basically you're saying once there's a majority, there's no speech rights for the minority is another way of saying it.
No, Knight and all the Supreme Court subsequent decisions have made clear that members of the bargaining unit have the same First Amendment rights as every other member of the public, but there isn't some special First Amendment right to force the government to listen to you. And that's really all exclusive representation is.
It's, so let me ask another question related to that. All Mr. Ault's saying is, look, my client has, and based on this record, I understand why, has a stigma of being associated with this union. And I mean, why does she have to be associated with it?
Well, I guess we dispute the premise that there's an expressive association. The Supreme Court has never found an expressive association where the complaining party didn't have to say or do anything, and where reasonable people would not believe that the complaining party actually agreed with or endorsed an organization or its speech. That's the test that runs throughout the Supreme Court's cases.
I mean, but if you look at Janice and Roberts and the stuff they're talking about, the freedom of association plainly presupposes a freedom not to associate.
It certainly does. And they have a freedom not to associate, as the Supreme Court held in Knight.
But I thought the statute requires her to be a member.
No. They do not have to be members of the union. Ms. Thompson's not a member of the union. She doesn't have to pay any money to the union. She doesn't have to do anything. She's not required to be a union member. The statute says, in fact, that she cannot be discriminated against in any way for not joining the union. And it's well understood that there are members of the bargaining unit who are not union members. They choose not to join the union, as is their right. And that's why that there isn't an expressive association between the people in the bargaining unit and the union, because there is no requirement of union membership, and because it's well understood that, as in any democratic system, some people will not support.
So I get that she's not quote unquote a member, but it is her exclusive bargaining representative by law, correct?
It is. The union has a duty to represent the entire unit. And as the First Circuit said in Reisman,
And all she's saying is, I don't want it representing me.
That's correct. But the representation is not a burden on her. It's a duty placed on the union to fairly represent all of the people in the bargaining unit, even those who choose not to be union members. And in Janus, the Supreme Court said that in the absence of such a duty, serious constitutional questions would arise from exclusive representation. And in fact, they said the duty of fair representation, the burden put on the union to represent the entire unit, is a necessary concomitant of an exclusive representation system.
I'm just curious, because I'm trying to figure out exactly what's in dispute here. Would you be willing to stipulate that your union does not represent Ms. Thompson's views and that you do not purport to represent her views when bargaining?
Well, we'd be willing to stipulate, and in fact, it's in a declaration from the union president, that the union understands that some members of the bargaining unit don't agree with the union's positions and that the union doesn't represent otherwise. It's in the declaration of the union president that R28.
Explain to me what's wrong with this stipulation I just said. You don't represent her views and you don't purport to represent her views when bargaining.
If your stipulation includes her views, we don't have a problem with it. And I submit it is what the union president said. And further, the superintendent of schools put in a declaration, and that's Mr. Hampton's declaration at R56-1, that the school district understands that not all of the people in the unit necessarily agree with the union. The union president's declaration also testifies that it's well understood that Ms. Thompson in particular doesn't necessarily agree with the union's views. And again, it's not unique to unions. People understand the parent association at a school doesn't necessarily represent the views of all the parents. The alumni association at a public university doesn't necessarily represent the views.
Right, but they, in a lot of cases, those aren't the exclusive representative. Right. Like a parents association isn't the exclusive representative of me as a parent. That is your, by law, you operate as an exclusive representative of her, which is her beef.
We operate as an exclusive representative of the unit for purposes of collective bargaining, which is a process, not a forum, as the Supreme Court said in Knight. It's just a particular.
If Knight didn't exist, could your position be squared with Janus?
Yes, because Janus explicitly said that exclusive representation could continue. And Janus, in the paragraph at issue, says that the government has more authority as employer than as sovereign. And it's in that paragraph that the court went on to say it's also not disputed that the government may require a union to serve as exclusive representative of its employees, itself a significant impingement on First Amendment associational freedoms that would not be tolerated in other contexts. We simply draw the line at requiring agency fees. So Janus draws a line between exclusive representation and requiring agency fees and says exclusive representation is entirely fine. So even if that dicta in Janus were the law, that dicta in Janus says that exclusive representation is constitutional. I want to also touch on the district court's alternative holding, which is that even if Knight didn't exist, and even if exclusive representative bargaining by itself were treated as an impingement on First Amendment rights that triggers heightened scrutiny, which was the argument rejected in Knight. Even if that were so, the system here would satisfy exacting scrutiny because the state has a compelling interest in being able to use an exclusive representative system because it's the only one that's proven effective in the United States. The district court's decision on that alternative issue is fully supported by the undisputed expert testimony in the record from three individuals with more than 40 years experience each with public sector collective bargaining, who all testified that collective bargaining would be impractical in the absence of an exclusive representative system where the government could deal with one representative and set unit-wide terms. That's the system that makes bargaining practical. Ultimately, it leads to labor peace, and it creates trust between the parties over time, as it has in this case. The testimony also showed that Ohio did have a labor peace problem. They were beset by strikes by public sector employees, especially in law enforcement, before they adopted their collective bargaining system. And since then, labor strife has dramatically decreased in Ohio. So even if we didn't have Knight, and even if exclusive representation did trigger heightened scrutiny, the district court would still be correct in its conclusion. But we acknowledge that this court does not have to go there.
This language from Janus, that a union serve as an exclusive bargaining agent for its employees, itself a significant impingement on the associational freedoms that would not be tolerated in other contexts. What do you make of that?
Well, that appears in a paragraph in which the majority is responding to the argument that because the government has greater authority as employer than sovereign, it should be allowed to require agency fees. And the majority responds at the start of the paragraph by agreeing that the government does have greater authority as employer. And then the majority says that's why we're applying exacting scrutiny, not strict scrutiny to
agency fees. Right, they're talking about Pickering, et cetera. But my point is still the exclusive bargaining agent for its employees is itself a significant impingement on associational freedoms.
That wouldn't be tolerated in other contexts, but in the employment context, it is tolerated because the government has more leeway as employer. So that paragraph is the majority explaining that it's not holding that exclusive representation is unconstitutional. It's drawing a line at agency fees.
So, well, the only alternative, if you don't have exclusive representation for purposes of collective bargaining, is to negotiate with each individual who is not a member of the union, and that's totally impractical. I mean, that would be the only other way to do it.
I agree, Your Honor. There are about 7 million public employees covered by exclusive representation systems.
There would be no bargaining, and you would go back to an at-will situation. And so, you know, the whole point of collective bargaining is that, I mean, you have to have so many people at the table, and you can't have hundreds of people at the table and negotiate individual contracts. It's impractical, that's all.
All right. Your Honor. I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Schmeek, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You are. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Brian Smink on behalf of the Marietta City School District Board of Education. I won't belabor the point that we take no position on the constitutional issues, but because the facts are so important often in injunctive relief cases, there are a few things that we wanted to emphasize. First and foremost is that the board doesn't attribute the union's collective bargaining positions to Ms. Thompson, or indeed really to any of the unit or even union members as individuals. Even with a contract that's been ratified by the union, we aren't privy to the union's internal deliberations or votes. We can only presume that majority rules, and so say 50% plus one of the individuals have ratified any given contract. And in the sense of analogous to legislation, you know, no particular provision may be adopted or approved by any individual. They've simply decided that as a whole, the agreement is perhaps the best, negotiated result that they can get, even if they disagree with perhaps many provisions. There may be simply one for each individual that trumps the others, and that may be true for everyone. The other reason that I say 50% plus one of the members is I'm referring to the union members, not to the bargaining unit members. Again, we don't know how the union internally operates its business, but Ohio law doesn't require a union to allow non-members, even as members of the collective bargaining unit as a whole, to vote to adopt contracts. There are state employee relations board decisions to that effect. So that's an extra reason not to attribute any of the positions to Ms. Thompson, because quite frankly, we think it's likely that she hasn't voted on any agreement as a whole. In addition to that, we think that the public probably doesn't attribute anything to any particular position to Ms. Thompson or associate her with the union, because the court can take into account the public's knowledge of how things actually work. And the public in Ohio, we think, well knows that public employees need not join their unions. And if they didn't know that before the Janus decision, it was well publicized. And I think it's likely that the public certainly now knows that no particular position can be attributed to Ms. Thompson. The final thing that I would add is that even if they did, I'm not sure how we would end up negotiating the result. And I would ask the court to be very, very clear with any changes it might make, because she doesn't want to negotiate on her own, and she doesn't want another entity to negotiate on her behalf. So I would simply ask that the court affirm the decision below.
Is Ms. Thompson allowed to speak to the school board at the end of school board meetings and to get her to to give her input if she objects to provisions of contracts or whatever that the union is negotiating? Does she have an opportunity to speak?
Yes, Your Honor. She has the opportunity to speak at school board meetings, just like any other member of the public. Additionally, the school board has provisions in place and a policy in place that allows teachers to share their thoughts on, you know, wages, hours, other working conditions.
Right. So they just don't have to negotiate with her, but they do allow her to speak, and they may or may not listen to her, but she is not denied her opportunity to speak. Even
That's
though
correct, Your Honor.
The union is the exclusive representative for bargaining purposes, she still has her own ability and vehicle to speak, that they don't speak totally for her. They bargain for her. And that's one of the problems. Everybody's saying, well, this is speech when you bargain. But technically, we're talking about bargaining. And the non-union members can still express their views. And they're still allowed to have their expression, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. There are
numerous they're not silenced because the union is the exclusive bargaining representative. They can still express their views and their opposition, right?
Correct.
And they're not members. They're not forced to join the union. They're not forced to pay for the union. And as Janice says in footnote 27, states can keep their labor relations systems exactly as they are, only they cannot force non-members to subsidize public sector unions.
That's correct, Your Honor. And those
change, Knight?
Not that I'm aware of, but again, my client takes no position on the First Amendment issues. We're simply happy to comply with the court's rulings.
All right, thank you.
All right, Mr. Ott.
Thank Mr. Ott, can you explain footnote 27 to me, where the Supreme Court, what I quoted you, and how you think that's consistent with your position?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that goes to, you know, it can be read, you know, somewhat in pari materia with its statement that it's undisputed, that they said it was undisputed that with regard to exclusive representation in that case. And that was literally true, which is to say, that was a statement on the impact of the decision in Janus. We don't argue that Janus per se overrules Knight or, you know, overrules exclusive representation. It certainly makes clear that that exclusive representation constitutes a significant impingement. And to the extent that other courts have ruled, like the court below or some other courts that have heard this particular question, that Knight says that there's no impingement, that clearly can't be true post-Janus. So it perhaps at least suggests that broad of a reading of Knight would be impermissible in light of Janus. I think that much is clear. But to say that the question was undisputed simply says that Mr. Janus did not raise that claim. Ms. Thompson does. And she does so in a way very differently than what was raised in Knight. If I can respond to a few claims that opposing counsel made, both counsel made arguments to the effect that the perceptions of the board or of the public with regard to whether or not Ms. Thompson agrees, is of significant moment, but case law says that it's not. In the Miami Herald case, the court understood that people, observers, understood that the newspaper running op-eds, they do so in running op-eds that aren't necessarily the position of the newspaper, but this was not enough to save the compelled speech in that case. Similarly, the court considered that issue in Hurley. In addition, opposing counsel argues that because Ms. Thompson can object, she has some other venue, that alleviates the unconstitutional burden of compelled speech. But again, both in Miami Herald, where they could print articles refuting those articles that they were forced to print, or Pacific Gas and Electric, in which the court rejected the argument that a utility could send its own response to advocacy articles that state law compelled them to include in their own mailings. that was not sufficient to cure the constitutional harm. So the fact that Ms. Thompson can go to a public hearing and make a statement does not cure the fact that she is completely barred from the negotiating process, that and that she has to associate as a matter of law with a designated representative in the form of the union.
Mr. Ault, can I go back to one point, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but so I understand it, your position on footnote 27 is exclusive bargaining wasn't being challenged in Janus. And where it said, the quote I read, that this wouldn't be tolerated in other contexts, it was scaling back Knight, correct? That's your argument. Go ahead, I'm sorry,
Your Honor.
No, go ahead. I don't want to make your argument for you, so I'll let you do it.
Judge Givens, I see my time is up. May I respond?
Sure.
Certainly, with regard to the impingement argument that they make there, I think my argument was that it makes impossible the district court's ruling in this case, insofar as it finds that Knight says there's no impingement, that it precludes impingement. And in fact, if you take a look, that position has been adopted by a number of other courts, pre-Janus in particular, but some post-Janus that have considered this issue. That's just untenable given the Janus decision. There I would say that Janus works, significant change, at least in how courts should understand the scope of Knight, which I think is important given the fact that we raise a very different claim than the claim that the plaintiffs raised in Knight, the claim that they had an obligation, that the state had an obligation to actually permit participation and to listen to arguments, whereas ours is simply that we cannot be forced to associate with a designated representative with whom we disagree. And for those reasons, Your Honors, I would ask that the opinion of the district court be reversed.
We appreciate the argument that all of you have given, and we'll consider the case carefully. Thank you.